This is a podcast from the Queen City Podcast Network.
And welcome to another episode of Queen City Nerves News Hounds podcast. I am Ryan Pitkin, and today I have a guest I've been wanting to talk to for quite some time, so I'm excited to have her here. We have City Council Member, District 4 Representative Renee Johnson. How's it going, Renee?
It's going very well. How are you, Ryan?
Very well, very well. I've covered nearly every city council meeting since you joined in 2020?
2019.
Yeah. Okay. And like I told you before we hopped on, I grew up in District 4 over in the Chestnut neighborhood. My parents still live in District 4, so I take a special interest in hearing the stuff that you discuss in these city council meetings. So it's a pleasure to finally get to meet you and chat with you a little bit about some of these city council issues. I guess we can just sort of start with how you came to be on city council. You told me that you moved to Charlotte 8 years ago. Where were you before then?
I'm from Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. and I moved to Charlotte in 2015.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that I walked in with an Ohio State rain jacket. You got excited for a second, but I had to tell you that's a former roommate's jacket. I do get accosted by Ohio State fans who want to talk football all the time when I'm wearing that jacket, but I just need to buy a separate rain jacket.
You certainly need to buy another jacket. We need to find you one because any Buckeye fan knows that. I mean, that's a cardinal sin to wear that jacket.
Well, I will say I'm not an anti-Ohio State. My best friend is the former roommate who left that jacket and I started wearing it. He is founder of the Browns backers. He's a big Cleveland guy. He's a huge Ohio State fan. So if you say OH, I'm going to answer IO.
Okay, good.
I'm not anti. Okay. I'll root for him when I can. So you came from Columbus. What brought you to Charlotte in the first place?
My daughter had moved to Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And so we followed my daughter when we had the opportunity. She has since moved back to Ohio. Okay. But
And you guys stuck with it.
We're here. Yes. Nice.
So what was it that sort of, we'll get into some of your work with Triumph Services and whatnot, but what was it specifically that on a political realm made you want to run for city council?
So I was involved. I started working on some political campaigns. Mm-hmm. Then I joined the Black Political Caucus. So I was just, I was so impressed at the Black Political Caucus because the elected officials are just so accessible. It really is like a family. So I'd sit on the same row with the congresswoman and the mayor and the judges, and just folks were accessible and around. So there was that. But I worked, because I have a nonprofit organization, that's one of the reasons I joined those organizations, is just to get to know people. And my organization, I worked with a young man who had suffered a brain injury and had a felony record. And because of the brain injury, he was disabled from working. So he received SSI, which is a form of Social Security, and he received $771 a month. Hmm. And I was trying to help him find housing. And I was just shocked by the lack of resources or availability. I mean, it was shocking. So because I had volunteered on some campaigns, I met some people. And then when Greg Phipps was not going to run again, someone said, there's a vacancy. Mm-hmm. You should run for office. And I just did not let fear stop me. Mm-hmm. So I'd been in public service for a long time. 30 years, and also had the nonprofit organization, and just an advocate for people. Mm-hmm. So when there was an opportunity to run for office, I did.
Right. And this is a very broad question. You could take it whichever way you want, but what has the experience been like in terms of the last 5 years of serving that maybe as someone who was politically involved, but not an elected official, you might not have realized about the life of an elected official in a big city like Charlotte.
So I'm so honored. Mm-hmm. I consider it a blessing to serve. I'm honored by the support from the residents of District 4. Hopefully I've earned your parents' support. Mm-hmm. But so the service part is easy. It's an honor. It's just naturally kind of what I do. The politics have been challenging. Mm-hmm. So there was That's that. I mean, the service is easy. The politics are harder than the service is.
Right. And just sort of going back, when did you launch Triumph Services?
2009.
Nine. Okay. And that experience you first discussed, helping the man find housing, that was after the fact, right? Or that's what inspired you to launch Triumph Services?
No, I launched... Jesse's World is the name of the organization, and Jesse was my mom.
Okay.
So Jesse's World, I provided reentry housing in Ohio for women with children. So when I moved here, and I ended up collaborating with a larger organization. So Jesse's World in Ohio provided housing for hundreds of women coming out of the prison for a long time, even after I moved, because I had collaborated with this organization. So when I moved here, I expanded the mission to provide service to men and women and provide the supportive services, because the housing piece was not as easy as it had been in Ohio.
Right.
For a couple reasons. In Ohio, there's funding for reentry housing, and there's not that resource here. And then the housing market, you know, it's very expensive. You can't just, I couldn't just go out and rent a house and then, you know, make it make sense financially. So instead of housing immediately, I went into supportive services and broadening my services. And Triumph Services also, in on my journey for reentry, my son had suffered a brain injury. So, and he has a tattoo that says tragedy to triumph. So Triumph Services is it's supporting this journey, this part of my journey as well.
Okay. So it was your son's experience that sort of brought you into this world of advocacy. I don't think it's one that necessarily as many people know about as might know about advocacy for those who are unhoused or advocacy for any number of issues. I don't think this is one that people really think about when they think about service and nonprofits and something you might advocate for. We're right now coming sort of to the end of Traumatic Brain Injury Month. You just read this proclamation into the record on at Monday night's city council meeting. Tell me a little bit about what you've learned while advocating for your son and because of your son, others in that sort of field. What does advocacy look like in that community? What are some of the misperceptions and things that people deal with in that with that issue?
There are millions that are affected by it. I could probably ask you if you've known anyone that suffered a stroke, an aneurysm, a concussion, a blow to the head. Most people know someone. And if you know someone that suffered a serious head injury, you know, people sometimes think they go through that recovery period and then they're okay. But what's not recognized is the lifelong challenges behind a brain injury. And we need to raise awareness about that. It can be life changing. And like I said, the gentleman I've worked with, you know, hundreds of people that have suffered a brain injury, and they're all different. The effect on that one person's life is as different as their personality. But there are some common challenges, such as memory changes, cognition changes, personality changes, substance abuse goes very closely.
Like self-medicating almost.
Yeah.
Lead to that.
Right. And the confusion for the survivors and the family after the brain injury, because of the lack of awareness, you're not given, many times when you're in the hospital, you're not given this document that says, here, this is what to expect. It's kind of a self-discovery process.
Right.
So my goal is to raise awareness and some consistent practices by the medical field so that individuals don't have that confusing discovery process.
Sort of ready them for that.
Right.
It's almost a reentry process in itself.
Yes, it is. And the cookie cutter approach does not work. If medical professionals aren't treating it correctly, then, you know, the wrong medications are given and just the wrong advice. So I have a support group for loved ones of brain injury survivors. I've had it since 2016. We've been meeting monthly. We meet the first Saturday of every month. We're meeting virtually now, and it's a family, and we share resources and just support one another and just share the advocacy. Epilepsy a lot of times goes hand in hand with the head injury. That's life changing in itself. Mm-hmm. So there's an awareness, and the numbers. I wish I could pull up the proclamation or I brought it with me, but the numbers are astounding. Mm-hmm. You know, the survivors of brain injury, it totals more than I think lung cancer and breast cancer and some other kind of cancer combined. Mm. So the numbers are astounding, and there's not a lot of understanding. So my goal is to raise awareness and understanding.
And I'll be sure to link that proclamation in the show notes.
Thank you.
/ yeah. Write up on the Queen City Nerve website that goes with this podcast. But yeah, it is some very, I don't want to say disturbing, but very startling numbers.
Right. Well, I mean, the statistics shows that 1 in 2 of homeless individuals have suffered a head injury. Mm-hmm. In the criminal justice system, there's a University of Denver report. It's like between or up to 87% of the individuals incarcerated that they studied had suffered a head injury. Women or individuals who've suffered from intimate partner violence, it's very prevalent there. Mm-hmm. So you see it in the court system and the criminal justice system, and we just need to... We need to raise that awareness and provide more resources. I'm on the State Brain Injury Advisory Council. I was in D.C. advocating for more funding. And
right.
So it's a lot of work. And I'm honored.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just honored to. Mm-hmm. I would not have chosen this journey. Mm-hmm. But since it chose me, I'm honored to be advocating for those warriors.
Right. And just how you just mentioned the intersectionality of it in terms of homelessness, incarceration, domestic violence, it really intersects with a lot of different issues that we've discussed in depth on this show. One of those being reentry support, something that you were involved with for a long time, as you just mentioned with Jesse's World. What was it that sort of drove that experience to sort of get involved with that?
Well, there's a need. Mm-hmm. There's just a need for compassion. I believe that we all deserve second chances. So there was a need for housing for women. So I've been in the criminal justice reentry field since 2009. And, you know, I continue to advocate for that population.
Mm-hmm. You had reached out, and that's sort of how we talked about what led to this podcast was talking to Latasha Young recently. And I assume you've worked with her. She was heading out on the way after this podcast to go to a simulation that you had organized. Tell me a little bit about how these simulations work, because I'm going to hopefully participate in the next one. I just sort of want to see. It sounded like an interesting thing, but I want to hear it from you rather than me try to third party describe what Latasha told me it is, but how these sort of give a first person experience.
A reentry simulation is an experiment. Mm-hmm. Of what it's like to return home from prison, your first month of prison. And so you're given these scenarios. It's like a live game piece. Mm-hmm. And you're given these scenarios. You know, Ryan, you're coming home from prison. You've been in prison for 10 years. You need to go to Social Security, find a job, start whatever the scenarios, find housing, all of that. And so you're given this experience or this scenario, and the barriers that people face, that's what you would experience, mm-hmm. such as not being able to find a job and not having the money to get the transportation or get your license or whatever those needs are. Mm-hmm. So it's real life. It's real life pitfalls that people experience when they come home from prison. Mm-hmm. So I was honored to have that simulation. I was told it was one of the best ones that they had. It was a lot of fun. And I wanted to invite policymakers and decision makers. So our assistant city manager was there, Ms. Frazier. She's over our workforce development. And I wanted to invite those policymakers. I'm hoping to have a bigger one. There was a police major that was there. How does this affect people trying to come home?
Right.
How do our actions and our policies create barriers for individuals? There's one issue I'm working on right now. There was a bus stop that was removed from in front of the federal halfway house. Mm-hmm. So that seems kind of minor, but these individuals now have to walk a mile to the bus stop. And one of the bus stops is right in front of a school. Mm-hmm. So if you've got someone who's, you know, may have sex offense on their record, mm-hmm. right? We need to make equitable decisions that impact folks like that, mm-hmm. right? So removing a bus stop from in front of the federal halfway house, it has more of an impact
right.
than it would removing another bus stop. Mm-hmm. You know, these folks have to work. If they get lost on a bus, they could violate their probation. And if they're, you know, if they're late getting back, and it just makes, I'm just advocating for the restoration of that bus stop. Councilwoman Brown and I both are. We were out at the federal halfway house last week mm-hmm. to hear from those gentlemen and also from the leaders of the halfway house. And we're advocating to have that bus stop restored.
And what are your thoughts, both locally and statewide? I think there's been some movement and momentum in this issue. You mentioned earlier Ohio has in place funding for reentry support that North Carolina lacks or lacked. We've seen the recent executive order by Governor Cooper to try to sort of put these agencies together and let there be better collaboration. Obviously, just on a local representation level, you just mentioned Councilmember Brown. She was on our podcast last year before even being elected, but she has her own history of incarceration and nonprofit that she launched, and that's brought some attention to the issue as well. Kenny Robinson was just on our podcast after Latasha to talk about the same issue. I'm sure our regular listeners are sick of hearing about reentry, but are you happy to sort of see? Or I don't want to put words in your mouth. Are you seeing this sort of same momentum? And do you think that there's some enough drive here to sort of make this maybe on the same level of what you saw the support in Ohio?
I'm happy to see
yeah.
the momentum. Yeah, because 95% of individuals who are incarcerated come home. Mm-hmm. So we have to provide services. You know, there's a book called The New Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And The New Jim Crow is just about a felony record can become the new Jim Crow. There's discrimination in housing mm-hmm. and employment, and it's legal. So, yeah, there has to be some changes because, again, people come home and what are folks supposed to do? Right. I mean, that's the question. I mean, if you can't work, I have a cousin who has a company that she hires folks to work from home. Mm-hmm. And she can't hire individuals with felony records. I'm like, you can't even work at home sometimes with a right. felony record. And I understand why. There are reasons for, I guess, for some crimes and boundaries around that mm-hmm. because of sensitive information. Mm-hmm. But I do advocate for more inclusiveness when we're looking at criminal background mm-hmm. records. I mean, there's people complain about not being able to find employees.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, let's ban the box. Let's open up access for individuals with criminal records to find employment.
CLT first. That's spelled CLT 1ST. It's a refreshing new podcast of Charlotte people, by Charlotte people, for Charlotte people.
No bots, no AI, just real human voices. We call it news for people who are so over local news.
We work with natural allies, all locally owned, like the Charlotte Ledger, Queen City Nerve, Charlotte Post, and many others.
We're all about local, local, local with minimal murder and mayhem. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Instagram.
Change your morning routine with us.
CLT first.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.
So moving on to the topic that's on everybody's mind these days, the last few city council meetings at the very least, has been the Unified Development Ordinance passed in 2022, which is why I was getting my years mixed up. You've been on since 2019, but you were definitely around during this 2022 debate and years leading up to that. You were one of the folks who had some opposition to it upon its passing. Tell me a little bit, just so that we have your sort of views on the record. I don't want to try to paint you as fully opposed to anything. What your thoughts were going into this on the original vote that it ended up getting approved on, what your opposition or your what your concerns were during that vote in 2022?
Well, most people know that there was a split vote.
Mm-hmm.
It was 6-5.
Right.
The five of us who were opposed, that was a bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats, council members from both parties were opposed to it. I've never been against a plan. We need any big city needs a comprehensive plan. I mean, I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in a large city. Mm-hmm. I understand that. My opposition was the provision 2.1, whereby duplexes and triplexes could be built on any single family lot, minus other provisions such as the HOAs mm-hmm. and setbacks, mm-hmm. but comparatively that they could be built on any single family lot. And that's what I was opposed to. I was also a real estate agent for over a decade. Mm-hmm. And I just think that there is a place for single family subdivisions. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. I believe that if a buyer buys a home in a single family subdivision and that's what they expect, then that's what they expect. Mm-hmm. And there are neighborhoods that don't have HOAs to protect them, such as Hidden Valley, College Downs, Grove Park. Grove Park has those great lots. I mean, they're prime for that type of development, and it can change the character of neighborhoods. And I thought that that was inappropriate. I think that newer subdivisions that where those expectations are clear to the buyers, I think that's fine. I like duplexes and triplexes and mm-hmm. quadplexes. I think they're sharp. I think there's a place for them, though. And that's what I was saying and most of us were saying as well.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about the duplexes and triplexes? Because I think this has become such an issue. These proposed changes will come in front of council later, May, July. One of them being to potentially sort of change the rules now around triplexes and sort of build on some of these people's, some members' opposition to, you know, where you can put triplexes. This would change it. The proposed change, not voted on, I want to clarify that, says that triplexes would move only to corner lots. Is this a sort of, I don't know, some people have said, you know, this is just the beginning of a rollback. Is this something that you want to further explore in terms of just getting rid of, is it 2.1B?
2.1, I think.
2.1B?
Yeah, I know it's 2.1.
Yeah.
The UDO is a living document, mm-hmm. so there's always room for improvement and tweaking.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's too soon to sort of make any read on the effects as it's been about 9 months since its implementation, not since its approval?
I think I know mm-hmm. that we're hearing from residents. I know that we're hearing from residents. One of the, you know, the petitions in my neighborhood, I think it was 2022-177 right outside of Lexington. Mm-hmm. That was a historical denial, and I'm honored to have led that, to listen to the residents. So we're hearing from residents that there's a petition on the south side with 20,000 signatures of what residents, you know, want to see. So I think that this is a response mm-hmm. to the committee referral when we sent this issue to the committee to take a look at. So I know this is a response. And no, I don't think it's too soon.
Mm-hmm. I know your District 4 is a very, I don't know what the word is. It's a specific type of district in that you have a college, you have the biggest university and one of the biggest in the state, definitely in the city. So there's a lot of density of housing around there. And there's a lot of suburban single family neighborhoods throughout District 4 as well. How do you feel about sort of that balance for needs? Because I think it's, I mean, Are you a firm, I mean, are you a strong believer that density, like we're going to need more density to sort of try to tackle this housing crisis and the you know, rent prices, not only just straight up build affordable housing, but housing for middle income and on all ranges.
Ryan, it just dawned on me.
Huh.
I remember your tweet. Are you the one that tweeted?
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to bring that up, and we can definitely discuss it because we brought it up on this podcast. And I even said, I think Joe Bruno was on when that happened. And I said, well, let me just talk to her about it so that we know. And I definitely did want to bring that up because that was about a specific, what was it? The bus.
Right. Yeah.
So we can discuss
that. I'm not on Twitter, right?
Right.
But it showed it. So you said Renee Johnson thinks District 4 is Ballantyne, and no one can tell her different.
Right.
So I don't know if you saw my response.
I did, yeah.
Okay, good. Because District 4 has more jobs, right?
Right.
So I do have a lot of commitment to District 4 and a lot of pride in District 4. Yes.
And you should.
I should. It's a beautiful district. Your parents live there. And I think District 4 residents expect me to try to protect the character of the neighborhood as much as possible. Yes, we're changing. I'm the last council member to have moved to the city.
Right.
So I know that we're changing. However, there is a need to be strategic and balanced in that growth. If you follow the meetings, I'm one of the first council members to talk about cumulative impact. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about cumulative impact. Infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I work with the Republican to champion an infrastructure meeting.
Right.
The only one we've had. This council's had in recent history. Yeah, we had an infrastructure meeting that I championed. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about infrastructure. So I'm not opposed to redevelopment. That's a misnomer about me. I mean, I'm a former real estate agent. I believe in growth and improvement, but there is a need for balance. Not every area needs to have the same amount of growth or the same type of growth. And that's it.
Yeah, definitely. And let's clarify the tweet too, because it's probably misguided the way I tweeted. What I was getting at there was, and I was working off an assumption, so that's why I wanted to sort of get your explanation of course, you should always want the things for your District 4 that maybe the nicer things that Ballantyne's gets should come to District 4 as well, 100%. What I was curious about was it seemed to me that you were just sort of trying to shut down the idea of bringing a Goodyear bus.
Greyhound
bus stop into University, full stop, just didn't want it on the agenda. And I was curious as to like why that would be.
I stopped it.
All right.
Right. Mm-hmm. From Greyhound being, I think it was going to be near or very close to the Walmart, in direct proximity of the University.
Mm-hmm. And the light rail stop.
Right. The light rail stop. Well, the University and University City Partners were opposed to it, and I agreed. So I did not think that it was appropriate that close to the university.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious as to like what is the opposition to a Greyhound stop? Is it just seen as a harbinger of, I don't know, crime or?
Well, it's open 24 hours, and we already have the Walmart that's open 24 hours, and it just seemed to be a concentration,
right?
Of a concentration of companies that were open 24 hours, and right that close to the university. We know that the city is one of the leading cities in human trafficking, and I just wanted to protect consider and protect those students as well.
Right.
And so I think that the Greyhound bus station is a better fit in a more urban area. And so that's why I was opposed to it.
Okay. That's fair enough. And maybe I should have brought that up right at the top, because I definitely wasn't coming in here thinking, oh, she doesn't know that was me.
No.
I didn't want to come in with any secrets. I thought that, but I definitely want to bring that up at one point just to sort of get your viewpoint on that. Cause I never asked you before, you know, just shooting off a tweet without knowing the explanation. So I appreciate that. I do want to talk about something you just mentioned in terms of the infrastructure discussion, because that's sort of an important part of what folks have been talking now with some of these developments that are facing opposition. I also want to talk about that South Charlotte development and some of those folks who are opposing, because it just that's sort of what strikes me, is that you see a lot of this community opposition, and it's what sort of hits me whenever I'm covering city council is you hear council members saying, you know, these neighbors are suffering, and I've heard that multiple times, like, these people are suffering, and I just don't really feel like I can buy that. In terms of the people who are really suffering aren't able to get out to meetings and whatnot. So I'm just, you know, these people took two charter buses to come, and we're talking about the South Charlotte development. I know this is not your district, so I don't want to just belabor the point of a South Charlotte petition, but it is a bigger news story that got a lot of coverage in terms of the Piper Glen development and the one lower down. But just, I'm just curious how to ensure that folks who are positively impacted by these developments are heard. Maybe if they're not, they might not be aware that they're going to be positively impacted at the same level that, you know, folks who want to put together an organized drive against it because they live in the area around it are heard and not. It's easy to make a confirmation bias when all you're hearing people speak at you are the ones who can show up and know the details behind it. How do you try to ensure that, you know, you're hearing from everybody? Or you're taking even that, like you just said, the cumulative impact, positive and negatives, into account when you're hearing just the negative feedback from community members in that sense?
We talked about on Monday the need to change the notification process. Mm-hmm. So we've got to make people more aware of what those yellow and blue signs mean. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that. I'm like, can we have a QR code? Can we have a more clear sign that says we're growing, we're changing, development coming, or something? Because we hear that often. People drive by those signs and don't know what they mean. I was really, really adamant about that when one of the motels was being redeveloped. Mm-hmm. People need to understand what that means. So we as a council need to make sure that there's notice or that the process is more clear to everyone and not just those who are aware or, you know, might be a part of the HOA or are informed. You know, we need to make sure more people are informed. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we can do. We talked about the notice that was in the Mecklenburg Times, right?
I was getting a kick out of that.
The Mecklenburg Times. Yeah. So, you know, what's wrong with the Observer or something, right? Or Facebook or something? So we've just got to be more transparent. And that's one thing I've pushed for, is transparency. So that's one way.
Feel free to buy space in Queen City Nerve. You're going to publish it there too.
Okay, that's a great idea, right? Queen City Nerve. So I just think that we've got to be, to ensure more transparency and look at things from an equitable perspective to ensure that people are aware of the process. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I think that's one way that we can address it. And again, growth and density and redevelopment is important, but does it need, we also have to consider and respect those individuals in those subdivisions. There's just a way to do it respectively and responsibly. Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned earlier, I wanted to talk about the infrastructure meeting you launched in 2022. And, you know, Tariq had just mentioned that during the, I think it was the last zoning meeting, sort of saying that, you know, we spent 2 years debating the ins and outs of this UDO and 2 days on infrastructure. Have you seen, now it's sort of coming up in conversations in terms of how to deal with impact on whatever it be, traffic, all the aspects of infrastructure. How have you seen, has anything come of that since that first infrastructure meeting? You know, should there be a committee? Should there be city planners, you know, sub office? I don't know what you would call it, to sort of focus on these things, because it seems like if there's still this amount of issues with it, then it's, I don't know where we need to accomplish something or move the issue forward.
So there has been some progress. We've had some updates in our council meeting. But what is that answer? I think that the presentation on Monday is a response as well. If we're really looking at the city, if we're really looking at the impact of the growth on the city, mm-hmm. my position was, I'll give you, and I'm looking for the, I'm trying to pull up the map. I apologize. Okay, so yeah, this is fine. One of the things that I had asked for. I don't know if you've seen this in a meeting. I've had this.
Oh, the car rides?
No, the map.
Car trips? Oh, right. Of just developments alone?
Right. So I've asked for maps mm-hmm. for District 4. That's one of the things that I want to see. I've also asked for one so that Councilmember Brown can see the cumulative development in her area as well. One of the things that the residents from the South Side, I think it was petition maybe 2023-046 or whichever one, the second petition on the South mm-hmm. Side, they had a map.
Right.
And what I said is you wouldn't believe that we don't get this map when we're making decisions mm-hmm. because we're not considering developments from a cumulative impact. We look at them one by one from a land use perspective. So if your petition has 900 trips and my petition has 2,000 trips, there's not going to be a traffic study because it didn't trigger the 2,500 trips that trigger a traffic study. Mm-hmm. However, cumulatively, there are 2,900 trips. Mm-hmm. So there should be a traffic study, but because there's not, the developer's not required to do a traffic study, but the neighbors are feeling the impact. Mm-hmm. So while not suffering from a suffrage
right.
definition, they are negatively impacted.
Right.
So I think that it's important. Another area where we look at development in a siloed approach is the impact on schools. And that's one of the things that I used to bring up. All this development, and I'm showing you a map, mm-hmm. right? I can send it to you. But all this development, we're looking at this one by one. But what is the cumulative impact on the schools mm-hmm. and on the traffic? So this map specifically was just along the Mallard Creek area. So, and that's what I was saying. And so that's why I looked so anti-development, which I'm not at all. Renee Perkins Johnson is not anti-development. But on this stretch, there was too much. Hmm. There was an inundation.
Right.
And so that's why I was opposed to that petition. So my thought is we need to look at areas like this where there's too much development and in District 5 where there's not enough, and just really start to even that out. I know we can't require developers, you know, where to buy, but I think that there has to be some consideration
right.
of that.
And how much are you looking at when you're considering these things in terms of the neighborhood opposition? I was looking at I got to take a deep look at this petition with the 2,000 signatures, and there's just so much. I mean, there's people from London and St. Louis and Denver, Colorado on here. And I mean, obviously there is, I'm not saying that there's not legitimate opposition from people who are there. I think there's, I took a picture of some data points that this is just for my own reporting, but there was, I think 10% of the petition was from the zip code. Just a ton of people from outside of the state. Do you guys, when you get these petitions and presentations, really put that data together? Or is it, you know, I don't know. Is it, what sort of consideration do you take into that? Because there's clearly an organized movement. They're chartering buses. Those are real people from Charlotte who are coming in, at least in the area. And then there's a petition that's just like, we can throw this number out, but there's not a lot of people there from right in that area. Is that carry weight in terms of how many people are actually from around that development that are standing against it?
I don't know that we've taken that deep of a dive to, I hadn't, to look at those zip codes to see, you know, where they're from. Mm-hmm. All I know is there's petitions with 20,000 names. And that does impact, of course, that makes us pay attention. But neighbors need to recognize when they come out and they oppose, it does have an impact on our decision. Absolutely. On the district rep, certainly in District 4.
Right.
I pride myself on being responsive to my residents. So I think that residents need to know if you're, you know, first of all, that yellow and blue sign means change is coming, right?
Right.
Look at, Google it on our website, City of Charlotte Rezoning, and then type in that petition number and find out what's going on in your neighborhood. And if you're opposed to it, then contact your city council representative or come to the meetings. Mm-hmm. You see that. Mm-hmm. So I first of all, we listen to our residents. It doesn't take 20,000 citizens. That chamber was full.
Right.
So, you know, those letters and coming out to council meetings, that does matter. So, yes, it has an impact on our decision. No, we didn't realize, I didn't realize that those signatures were for London or Denver. Right. But there's still, I mean, 20,000 signatures. I mean, there's quite a few people in Charlotte and in that area that we're hearing from. And
right.
They are concerned about the development. Mm-hmm. Many, now I will say there's times where we hear from neighbors who opposed, and we have to take in consideration, you know, if not this, then what?
Right.
I had a petition in District 4, and neighbors were opposed, but it was single-family attached units. And I knew that if that wasn't approved, the next thing that could come down the pipeline could be multifamily.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have to consider the district as a whole. So that happens as well.
And I think that was a good point that Ed Driggs brought up during the whole Piper Glenn debate, was that there's still a chance that if this doesn't go through, something else with more impact could even go through without a rezoning. And that's always something to consider. So sort of just in terms of whether there's something UDO related or beyond that, sort of before we get out of here, what are some of the issues now moving forward for the rest of this year or your the current term that in District 4 specifically that you really are sort of laser focused on and don't think is getting enough discussion or maybe is getting a lot of discussion and you want to sort of put work into?
I want to continue to support the small businesses in District 4. I know with the growth, and we've had this discussion the last couple meetings, we want to make sure that small businesses aren't displaced. Supporting small businesses.
That's a huge development going on over there at Food Lion.
I know.
Across UNC Charlotte. That's going to be a lot of moving around.
And I went to all of those small businesses on that row, gave them my card, and told them if they had any concerns about displacement, let me know. I wanted to have a meeting with the developer prior to the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't hear from anyone. I spoke to some of them, and the ones I did speak to said they'd already talked to the developer and there was a plan and that they were comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. But I had that vote, if you recall, it was deferred. The decision was deferred for a month. And the reason is because I wanted to speak with the small businesses myself. Mm-hmm. So I do walk my talk.
Yeah.
And so I went to meet with all the small businesses or attempted to. I also had reached out to University City Partners and they reached out to the small businesses to make sure that they knew that they would have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Terry, the CEO of that company, just yesterday. I'm going to stay engaged with him and work very closely. I'm looking forward to that. And I think redevelopment, it's a great thing, but it's important that residents or those affected or impacted are part of the change and not to be displaced by it. Another priority for me is the revitalization of North Lake Mall. I'm committed to supporting North Lake Mall. We've got some great development surrounding North Lake Mall. We've got a Porsche Maserati dealership that's going to elevate that whole area. We're hoping to get folks from Lake Norman to come down and shop in that area. So I work closely with the CEO of North Lake Mall, and there's a revitalization. There's a lot of Black businesses. I don't know. There was an article recently to talk about that. So that's a priority for me, the small businesses and North Lake Mall.
Well, my fiance is starting to really get moving on community engagement work around the Red Line, which I'm sure will be, obviously, that's years down the road in terms of really impact, but that will be a huge aspect of that.
Congratulations to your fiance on being one of the great 28.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. I ordered that magazine. Where's that magazine?
I don't know.
There was something I wanted to bring up that you just reminded me of. We were talking about the old Kohl's and Food Lion. Oh, I don't know a whole lot about this. I'll give Joe Bruno the credit. He's been reporting on it. But the Turkish coffee house it's working to open on J.W. Clay. And I think there was some confusion around the whether they could stay open later on Ramadan. And now Joe Bruno is reporting that maybe there is some discussion around allowing them to open. I only felt connected to the story because we had just published a story about Haraz, which opened on Central, and it was like one of the very few Turkish spots like that in Charlotte. Is there momentum there so that it's not just a dead in the water?
Yes, it's not just dead in the water. Okay. Keith Stanley, the executive director of University City Partners, is working with CATS. He's really advocating for that because it will be a great benefit and a great resource in our community. So we're working through that, and hopefully there'll be some positive developments.
Awesome. The boardwalk is crazy. I went to Boardwalk Billy's last year for my first time in a long time, and I grew up in I went to UNC Charlotte, obviously, going to boardwalks all the time, but just the development looking out from that patio is crazy. So nothing's changed. Everything in this city is changing, but I feel like University City is one of those where if you don't go back for a year, it becomes unrecognizable.
So I moved here in 2015. I didn't know all that was back there. So I went to, that's when TJ Maxx was there, and there was a shoe store. I was looking for some shoes, and I couldn't find them in those two stores. And I went around this corner and I saw swans and lights, and it was like an Alice in Wonderland experience.
It's about Easter weekend. We would have been there this weekend. That's where we used to go all the time, spend the Easter Sunday at the boardwalk.
It's beautiful over there. And even throughout the pandemic, you know, that was a great place to be.
Right.
We maintained businesses over there. And so University City is a great area, and I'm honored to represent it. You know, we're going to have I think it's a 6-story library that's going to be built over there.
Yeah,
the novel, those apartments. I mean, it's a great area.
Absolutely. Yeah. I could sit here and talk to you about University City all day, but I don't want to be here till nighttime. Is there anything we haven't touched on you think is important to mention?
No, I've ask your listeners to watch our meetings, hold us accountable, for our votes as well. And I thank you for your engagement. I thank you that you break down the meetings into the bite size. Understand?
Right,
yes, the quickies, that's important. So thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for having me.
It's definitely one of the more engaged things we do and get the most thank yous in response for, because a lot of people don't have the time to sit through the 5 or 6 hour meetings, but you and I do it because it needs to be done.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on, Renee.
And, thank you.
I'm sure I'll talk to you soon enough, but till the next time. Cheers.
Thank you.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.